I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. When Abigail Marsh was 19 years old, a stranger saved her life. She was driving late at night and swerved to avoid a dog in the highway. Her car spun across the oncoming traffic, and she found herself facing backwards in the fast lane. A man stopped his car, ran across six lanes of traffic, jumped in her car, steered it to safety, checked that Abigail was okay, and drove off. It happened so fast she didn't have time to thank him or even get his name. A few years later, she was partying in Las Vegas and being harassed by a stranger. When she slapped him to get him to stop, he punched her in the face, breaking her nose. Later, a group of strangers found the man and beat him up. These incidents got Abigail Marsh interested in extraordinary altruism. These are people who risk their life to help someone they have never met, and the opposite, people with little or no capacity for empathy. She wrote about these experiences and her research findings in her book, The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. She's a professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University. And she joins us on The Connection today to talk about the neuroscience of extremes, why fear drives our behavior in good and bad ways. And Abby Marsh, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thanks for having me.
I know you're very, 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 very familiar with those stories, but I remember interviewing you when your book came out in 2017, and there was something that man who saved your life on the highway said to you, and it's so simple but also so profound. He said, "It looks like you could use some help." And yeah, that has just kind of stayed with me these last 9 years, because it says so much about him.
Yeah, it does. I've had the opportunity since I met him to meet so many people who are unusually altruistic, who have helped strangers by donating a kidney or a piece of their liver or rescuing them from danger. And what's been so remarkable is how straightforward the decision was for all of them, pretty much without exception, that they saw somebody who needed help and they thought, "I need to do something."
Why do you think we human beings tend to underestimate the goodness in other people or of other people? I think if you ask probably a lot of people just off the top of their head, are people basically good or basically not good? Probably people would tend towards the not good, especially these days.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think that is? Why don't we see the goodness in people?
That's a great question. I mean, we know from big national polls that most people believe that the average person is just looking out for themselves or can't be trusted. And those numbers have gotten worse over time. So America was the country with the highest level of generalized trust pretty much anywhere in the world several decades ago, but it's dropped a lot since then. I think there's a couple of culprits. Both traditional media and social media are really incentivized to show us the worst of other humans. That's, you know, the old phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, is a, you
Indeed.
Know, a really good indicator that there's no payout for showing people doing really good things. And there's exceptions, right? I mean, of course. But having talked to a number of journalists now, it seems like there's a little bit of a perception that talking about things like people doing good things for other people is soft. That's sort of fluffy. and serious journalists talk about people doing terrible things to others. And in addition, the problem is that is what the audience wants. People love that kind of stuff. I mean, that is explains why people love true crime and you know, the horror genre. We have a real fascination with reading about the worst things that other people do. But the problem is our brains are like a little statistical calculator, sort of generating averages of all the information that comes in. And if the vast majority of the information you learn about people out there in the world, including strangers, is about the terrible things that they've done, your brain is going to develop a composite image of the typical person as a terrible person. And social media, of course, is also terrible this way, right? Social media, we know that the algorithms are designed to show us things that will cause us outrage, which is often people doing terrible things.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about fear, because obviously if people are doing terrible things, we are afraid, or that makes us afraid. Help us understand, I guess, this ancient emotion. One can understand how fear helped us survive, because we had to be on the lookout for all the dangers that surrounded us many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah, we need fear. Fear is our friend. In fact, it's often called a negative emotion because, depending on the context, it doesn't always feel good to feel afraid. But it's not a negative emotion in terms of how helpful it is for us. We absolutely need it to survive from danger and escape and avoid danger, avoid getting in a pickle in the first place. Depending on the situation, the benefits of confronting dangerous situations are often not nearly as high as the potential costs of being in danger. And so our brain is just very biased to pay attention to things that are scary, and to want to avoid them and to put a lot of weight on things that scare us. So yeah, we're kind of, most of us, and people vary a lot, so
Sure.
not everybody experiences fear as strongly, but in general, most people are pretty biased to really pay attention to their fear and obey it.
Well, I'm thinking of those people living, let's say, in war-torn parts of the world, or perhaps even in violent neighborhoods, or maybe even living in a family where there is violence. We know about, fight, flight, fear, and now we're learning about something called fawning, where you sort of fawn in order to protect yourself from a person who is a danger to you. Just wondering about the sort of hyper arousal when you're living in and amongst fearful things.
Absolutely. And fear is very adaptive in situations where you actually could be seriously injured or killed, as was true for humans for most of our history. The world was very dangerous. I mean, I was walking through a neighborhood near my house the other day at night with my dogs. And thinking how very, very few generations of humans anywhere in the world have been able to walk, and my neighborhood has woods on either side, how very few generations of humans have been able to walk at night near or through the woods without any danger of some sort of large carnivore coming out and eating them,
That's
right? That's
right.
that was normal for most of human history. And human activity has mostly gotten rid of large carnivores. And so we just don't have to be afraid of as many things day to day. As humans, I mean, we have large scale sort of existential things that we're afraid of now, but that's quite different than the sort of day-to-day fear our brain was built to live with. And so, you could argue that our brains are just not well matched for our current environment. We have a lot of capacity for fear, but day-to-day life doesn't really require it a lot of the time for
And
most
yet,
people.
we often do react with fear or anger, all the associated emotions, maybe overreacting. And one of the things
Yeah, I mean,
that I saw you say about fear, fear gets bored easily. That was a quote from you.
absolutely. Right. You can't, I mean, there's a really interesting argument that it's important to expose yourself to things that scare you because that helps your brain sort of learn to regulate its fear. It's almost like fear functions a bit like an allergy or like your immune system. And if you're not exposed to actual risks and dangers, especially growing up, your brain sort of loses its ability to figure out the difference between a real threat and not a real threat and overreacts to everything fearfully, because it didn't sort of learn to titrate earlier on. Enough exposure to risk to keep your fear from getting bored might actually be a good thing.
Well, I'm thinking of doom scrolling, right? I mean, that's a way of putting us into a fear state, right? And yet we do it.
Absolutely. We do it. I mean, again, our brains are looking for danger because that is a, way to enhance your own prospect of survival, which biology is very interested in. And if the world is willing to give you an endless stream of things that are potentially hazardous to your health, you have to use a lot of conscious willpower to stop yourself from continuing to consume that information.
You've done such fascinating research having to do obviously with fear, but also the amygdala in the brain. And if you could sort of walk us through what the amygdala does. And I read that it's kind of an alarm system for the brain. I don't know if you're comfortable with that very unscientific description, but what do we need to know about the amygdala?
Sure. It's an evolutionarily ancient structure. We share it with all mammals and some other kinds of animals who aren't mammals. You know it's important if it's been around that long. And it plays many roles. It does lots of things. But one of the things it does seem to be particularly important for is alerting us to potential danger and helping us learn from potential dangers so that we can avoid those dangerous things in the future. The short story is that information that enters our brain from our eyes or our ears or our nose about a potential threat gets routed very quickly to the amygdala within milliseconds. And usually just sort of a very fuzzy kind of sensory image of what the threat is so that the amygdala can react right away just in case the threat is serious. This is why we often find ourselves, for example, if you're on a walk and you see like a squiggly shape, like a piece of rope on the ground, you might find yourself leaping away from it immediately before you even know what you're doing because your amygdala immediately thought, oh my God, it could be a
Snake,
snake.
right.
Right, exactly. And that's a very deep evolutionarily ingrained fear. That's a good indicator of the fact that we can't always control what it's doing. It's doing its own thing. What the amygdala does is it's the most densely interconnected structure in the primate forebrain, meaning it's got message channels out to everywhere else in the brain. When it detects a threat, it sends that information out throughout the brain to help you coordinate a response, running away,
Fighting.
hiding, fighting in some situations, usually when there's no other possible way to avoid the threat.
But what you're saying in terms of the amygdala reacting, it's basically sending out messages to the brain, the body, that danger, 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 danger. You need to do something to protect yourself.
Exactly. And that's its immediate response, right? It sends messages to the hypothalamus, which regulates the autonomic fight or flight system, gets hormones like cortisol flooding through your bloodstream and changes the way that your heart and lungs and blood vessels and muscles are prepared to respond to danger. Now, after that initial response that the amygdala gives, the message goes out to regions of the cortex, the surface of the brain, that sort of refine the signal and tell the amygdala, oh, look, it's not actually a snake. It's just a rope. We can calm ourselves down. And then also the frontal cortex, the front of the brain, which actually can use sort of judgment and reasoning to decide even if it is a snake, it's a harmless one, or even if it is a snake, there's something more useful to do than leaping up in the air and shrieking, and help sort of use more conscious processes to regulate your emotions. But that all takes time. And it also takes cognitive resources if you're tired or distracted or thinking about other things. It sometimes can be hard to use those abilities to calm yourself down again.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And Abby, I do want to talk about altruists and their amygdala, something that you have looked at. And again, talking with Abigail Marsh today on The Connection, and we have been talking about the role of fear in our lives, how it can inspire us to overreact to situations, but also keep us safe as well. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Here's a question we have been pondering. Why would someone risk their life to help a perfect stranger? That happened to our guest psychologist, Abigail Marsh, when a man she never met saved her life. We're talking with her about why people engage in selfless acts, and we'll be talking about the opposite, what explains psychopathic behavior. We've been talking about the amygdala. Now, you look specifically at the amygdala of kidney donors. These are people that donate one of their kidneys to a perfect stranger. So clearly, these are very altruistic people. So when you looked at their brains or their amygdala, what did you see?
Well, what we were looking for was evidence that they were the opposite of people who were very uncaring. So this was my best guess when we first started research on very altruistic people, is that people intrinsically vary in their capacity to care about other people, not necessarily permanently. I think people can change over their lifetime. In fact, I'm sure they can. But we hadn't done any research on very altruistic people before, and certainly not their brains. And so the best information I had about what to look for came from extremely uncaring people or
Okay.
psychopathic people, in whom a brain structure, the amygdala, which is responsible not only for coordinating the experience of fear and learning from fear, but also when you encounter somebody else who's afraid, simulating their fear, which allows you to help empathize with them and respond appropriately. And in people who are psychopathic, the amygdala tends to be smaller than average. It tends to be under-responsive to other people's fear, suggesting that they don't empathize with it or respond appropriately to it, which is one reason they so often do things that cause it. And these problems mean that they're not very good at recognizing when other people are afraid. So if they see, somebody looking afraid or sounding afraid, they often actually have no idea how they're feeling because it's very hard to empathize with and recognize emotions that we don't feel ourselves. So my prediction was that people who were very altruistic would look the opposite, that they would have amygdalas that were larger than average, more responsive to other people's fear, which is a sign of acute distress, and maybe would be better at recognizing it as well. And somewhat to my surprise, that is exactly what we found.
It's nice to
Their
be
brains
right,
don't.
isn't it?
Science keeps you humble.
Yeah, indeed.
That
I'm
it
sure it
happens
does.
pretty often you don't find what you're looking for. So this is a nice exception to that. So what that suggested is they sort of have anti-psychopathic brains that make them extra attuned to other people's distress, including the distress of complete strangers. And that is, in retrospect, one of the most interesting aspects of our findings. Most people are really good at empathizing with and tend to empathize with the distress of people that are close to them that they care about. And what's really interesting about altruists is that they extend that empathy and care to people they don't know.
Well, and I don't know, it'd be interesting, and I don't know how deep in the amygdala you could go, because I was thinking about, these extraordinary altruists, and this is the man that saved your life. These are people that donate kidneys to strangers. Whether there's something unique about them versus people who, because you have to, maybe it's the difference between not thinking about doing something and then thinking about having to do something, whether there's a difference between these extraordinary altruists and the rest of us.
Absolutely. I do think one of the differences with the altruist is the strength of their desire to help when they first encounter somebody who needs help. And what's really been cool is that actually, since my book was published, quite a lot of animal research has come out, localizing the motivation to help others in danger in the amygdala, even in mice and rats. So it turns out that when mice encounter another mouse who's been knocked unconscious by researchers, they try very hard to resuscitate it. They'll sort of fiddle with its mouth, they'll like poke at it. Eventually, they'll even try to pull its tongue out, which, if it's choked or something, I guess would be useful. Sometimes these activities even do revive the mouse. But it turns out that if you ablate or if you knock out the amygdala's functioning, this stuff doesn't happen.
That's wild. That's
I know,
wild.
it's really wild. And so something, I do feel confident that something is happening within the amygdala that's really hard to actually figure out in humans. We can't, use the same research techniques with, we can't knock out a human amygdala, of course. And so, what exactly is happening that gives them that extra strong response to others' distress? We don't know. But then, of course, as you say, what's also interesting about them is that they then don't change their mind. They're not like, oh, I want to help, but oh, I'm busy, I'm in a hurry, what if I get hurt? The strength that their desire to help other people seems to keep those other kinds of concerns at bay.
Well, I was thinking about, would I have done for Abigail Marsh what that man did for her, and I would think of that as a kind of split second decision where he saw you were clearly in distress and I don't know what his thinking was, but he ran across, risked his life to save your life versus someone that might decide to give a kidney to a stranger, because that requires so many multiple steps. Besides the initial decision, then you have to go through various steps in order to make this thing happen. Do you see that as the same or somehow qualitatively different?
I do think, and some of our research supports this. So we have done more recent research looking at studies where we assess sort of how much subjective weight or value people place on others' welfare. And people who are psychopathic place very little subjective value on others' welfare. So what that means is when it comes to a decision that pits your welfare against my welfare, yours counts very little and mine counts a lot. And the average person genuinely cares about other people's welfare. I feel very comfortable saying this. It's just they
Good.
usually care about their own welfare more, especially if the other person's a stranger. What's so interesting about altruists is that they genuinely value the welfare of people around them more, and that includes people close to them, but it especially includes strangers. And it does seem to be the case that people who have donated a kidney or a piece of their liver to a stranger have some of the highest rates of valuing other people's welfare very, very highly. You know, as even when they're thinking about a stranger, they value their welfare. They care about them as much as most people care about people very close to them, like good friends or family members. And so it does feel like people who donate organs to strangers are sort of among the altruistic elites, although I will caveat that by saying they would be horrified to hear me say
Well, that's what's
that.
so interesting is they're very humble. They don't see themselves as special, right? That's the
Yes, I
wonderful
know.
irony about altruists.
It is. I love it. And I think this is such an important thing to clarify because I get the impression that many people believe that altruists sort of feel superior to other people. You know, they're like, oh, I'm a better person than you. And what I have 100% experienced is that true altruists do not feel that way. Genuinely altruistic people, which includes, you know, all of the groups of altruists that I've worked with, are really humble people. They do not believe that they're special. They do not believe that they're different. They do believe that almost anybody who was in the situation that they were in with the same knowledge that they have would have been likely to do the same thing. And that I think fundamentally makes a lot of sense because if you truly believe that you are the most special person around, AKA you're a narcissist, highly narcissistic person, it doesn't make any sense for you to risk your own safety or sacrifice your own resources for less special people, right? The special person should be the one with all the goodies. But it fundamentally makes sense if you think that everybody's special and everybody's welfare matters, that if you have something that would save another person's life and you could do without it, it just makes sense to share it with somebody else who's nearly as special as you are.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Abigail Marsh, our guest today on The Connection. She's a psychologist professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University. Wrote a book a number of years ago called The Fear Factor. And we've been talking about both altruists, and we will get to the psychopaths as well, because there are some really interesting connections. But thinking about altruists and thinking about courage and even fear. How do they think about what it is to be courageous or to
Oh
be
yeah, this is
personally courageous?
yeah. So this is a great question because it's a really common misconception of very altruistic people who take risks to help others that one of the reasons they took that risk is because they're fearless. They don't worry about getting hurt. Danger doesn't bother them, and the truth seems to be the opposite. So this includes, even people who do things like run into fires to save people from burning buildings. They never describe themselves as actually fearless. One of my favorite examples is Senator Cory Booker, the former mayor
Oh,
of
yeah.
Newark, New Jersey, who many it happened so long ago, and he never talks about it. Many people don't know that he rescued his neighbor from a house fire. I mean, he ran up into the second floor of a house that was, engulfed in flames to find his neighbor's daughter, I think it was, grope his way through this smoky, fiery bedroom, get her off a bed, throw her over his shoulder, and get right back out of the house again. He ended up
Wow.
having to go to the hospital because he had burns and smoke
Wow.
inhalation damage. And he had to fight his bodyguard off to get him to do this. And of course, I mean, it's the sort of thing, it's like a real life superhero kind of behavior. That led many people to assume that he's this absolutely stoic, fearless semi-superhero. There were quotes on social media like Cory Booker isn't afraid of the dark. The dark is afraid of Cory Booker.
Right.
But if you actually listen to him interviewed about it afterward, he talked about how terrified he was in every single interview. You know, he used words like terrified, terror, thought I was going to die, freaking out. The difference between truly altruistic people, and this includes kidney donors too, who, you know, some of the donors that I've worked with have needle and blood phobias. They pass out when they get their blood drawn. It's not
That's
that they're not
wild.
afraid of the medical procedures or generally fearless people. They're never, you know, I mean, with very few exceptions, big risk takers. The difference between being fearless and being brave is that a fearless person truly doesn't appreciate the danger and they're sort of reckless. It's not really a virtue. A brave person is somebody who appreciates the danger but cares about something else that's more important than the danger. And in the case of altruists, it's the lives and welfare of other people. It just they care about it more than the risk to themselves.
I know there's an argument that altruists, you know, get such benefit from their altruism, raising the question, well, are they really altruists if they get all this goodness out of it? I know you've thought about this a lot, but I'd be curious about what you say to that argument.
Yeah, I mean, this was even the subject of a very famous Friends episode,
Oh,
you know,
that's
where
right.
Joey challenged Phoebe to, you know, come up with an act of altruism that the person didn't benefit from. And he ended up sort of winning the argument by pointing out that if people who help others feel good about having helped them, well, then they're benefiting. And so it's not really altruistic. And this is very common theory. You know, I have a couple of responses to it. One is that I think it sort of confuses cause and effect, right? We can feel good about having done something, even if feeling good wasn't the goal of the action to begin with. And that absolutely is my experience working with altruists, is that, I mean, the last thing on their mind was how they would feel afterward. They just saw a need and wanted to fill it. And oftentimes in the flash of an eye, right? Well before they could have done cost benefit analyses. Another way I like to think about it is to say that if we believe that it is selfish to take pleasure in helping other people, then that would mean the most unselfish person was somebody who helped other people begrudgingly and was pissed off about having done it afterward. And that doesn't quite
That
sit
makes no
right. Like
sense. No.
that's not what anybody means by an altruist. And so really, I think the reality is it's been best described by the Buddhist monk and neuroscientist Matthieu Ricard, who wrote a beautiful book called Altruism. His explanation is that taking joy in helping other people is what it means to be altruistic, because only an altruistic person would find pleasure in helping another person. And I think that's fundamentally true, that we are at such a social species. We are built to be deeply interconnected and interdependent on one another. To the point that the people that we love and care about, whether they're your close family or a stranger whose welfare you care about, feel like an extension of our actual self. And helping them is just intrinsically rewarding and something that we were truly built to do.
And I would,
Well, linked to us.
yeah, exactly. Well, I would assume that if it's rewarding, then chances are we would do it again because it makes us feel better, maybe even makes us happy, if I dare
Yes,
say
this
that
is.
word.
Absolutely. And it is one of the interesting paradoxes about altruism is that you get the most rewards out of it, including the most well-being, if your goal in helping the other person was in fact unselfish, right? If your goal is to benefit yourself by behaving altruistically, it doesn't give you nearly as much of a well-being boost. But assuming you were helping out of a true desire to help, yes, you do feel good about it afterwards. It does boost your well-being. And this in many people creates this lovely sort of upward spiral of doing it again and again. For example, most of the altruistic kidney donors I've worked with have been longtime blood donors. Nobody ever starts with a kidney. It usually starts with blood, sometimes some bone marrow or plasma after that. And then they think, gosh, I mean, that felt great. I love knowing that I was able to help all these people, you know, at very little risk or cost to myself. Why not a kidney?
Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, smaller acts of altruism. I mean, even as mundane as holding the door for somebody else. I mean, does that, if we're talking about altruism, does that count?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. And I'm sure we can all think of times where we did something that felt small in the moment to help a stranger, you know, hold a door for somebody who's obviously struggling with their bags or pick up something somebody dropped. Or just the other day, I was walking across campus and somebody was lost and I helped them get where they were going. And they were just, you know, it felt like such a small thing to me, but they were just so kind and grateful about it. that it made me feel wonderful. And it just feels like a no-brainer to do something like that again. And again, not because, oh, I love that wonderful feeling, but because that wonderful feeling is signaling to you that you've done something consistent with your values and the kind of life that you want to live.
Also, that you are seeing another person, right? That you're looking out in the world and you're seeing other person, maybe reading their emotional state so that you know how to respond.
Exactly. And of course, one of the many benefits of altruism is experiencing the vicarious joy of the person that you helped. When you somebody experiences pleasure, we always get a little empathic surge of joy when somebody around us that we have a connection to is happy. But that surge seems to be even bigger if we know that we were able to bring about that joy.
I'm thinking about the 9/11 responders. You mentioned other, responders whose job it is to literally put their life on the line to save strangers. And thinking of those 9/11 responders going into the Twin Towers, sort of knowing, absolutely knowing that the chances of them getting out alive were next to none. And we know that many of them, of course, died. Do you think
Of
those
course,
people are
actually,
attracted?
one of them was the father of one of my graduate students who worked
Oh, really?
with me on
Oh
this
my gosh.
research.
Wow. I mean, I would assume people, and we have about a minute before our second break here, but I would assume they're attracted to those jobs because they have some degree of altruism in them normally. Is that true? Or
I think
naturally, I should
so. I
say.
mean, I cannot imagine wanting to do one of these jobs if you didn't find it intrinsically rewarding to help other people and know that you were somebody who had what it takes. You were unusually physically fit or strong, of course, or in other ways had the capacity to help in ways that not everybody could. And I'm sure that that's true.
And thinking in altruistic ways, does it make us trust the world and trust other people more?
There's a really strong relationship between being having sort of a positive view of other humans and being altruistic. And the cause and effect probably goes both ways, I would assume. I think when you have a tendency to assume the best about other people, and in the absence of, knowing for sure what other people are thinking, just believing they're probably trying to do their best, which most people are, makes you much more likely to want to help them, because if other people are jerks, like, why would you want to help them? But then in addition, helping other people brings positive social interactions your way that gives you information about how truly good most other people are. And so I think they become self-reinforcing.
Well, we have been talking about altruists on The Connection today with our guest psychologist, Abigail Marsh. After this short break, we'll spend some time talking about psychopathy, the opposite. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I have been talking with a psychologist, Abigail Marsh. Again, she's a professor in the Department of Psychology and the Interdisciplinary Neuroscience Program at Georgetown University. And she has spent her career looking at altruists and looking at people who are psychopathic and trying to understand what drives their behavior. And it seems like fear is such a powerful and ubiquitous driver of behavior in good ways and bad. So let's talk a bit about people with psychopathic traits or tendencies. Broadly speaking, how would you describe their, I guess, traits, their personality? How would we identify them?
Great question. So yes, psychopathy is definitely painted in very exaggerated ways a lot of the time, because of course that's much more fun in movies and books. And so the reality of psychopathy is, I think, both a little bit more pedestrian, but the ways in which it's pedestrian, I think, make it a little scarier than most people realize. So psychopathy is a personality disorder, and psychopathic traits vary continuously in the population. So it's sort of hard to estimate how many people are psychopathic because it kind of depends on where you draw the line. But most people would draw the line at this person is struggling to function because of these psychopathic traits, which include generally a bold, fearless, socially dominant personality. And that often starts quite early in life. So this is often one of the indicators that a child is at risk for developing psychopathic traits. Which I should emphasize are a neurodevelopmental disorder. So nobody develops these traits as an adult. They tend to start early.
Would that be bullying behavior? I mean, sort of as a way to understand that dominant, aggressive kind of behavior you described?
Exactly. Psychopathic children are much more likely to bully other kids. And that's especially true if they're not so-called victim bullies. So many children who have been victimized by bullies then go on to bully others, but not all kids. Some kids who are just bullies without ever having been bullied themselves. And those kids are much more likely to have what we call callous unemotional traits. So that's these traits in their childhood form. And they are also traits we see in psychopathic adults, which include callousness or a lack of concern or caring about other people's suffering, lack of remorse, so lack of caring about having caused other people's suffering, as well as a somewhat sort of disinhibited, somewhat reckless personality. And then other traits that go along with it are the tendency to manipulate other people, to lie, in some cases at pathological levels, and to sort of use other people instrumentally to achieve your own goals.
Can they be mistaken for people with charisma? Is that something that, also sort of meets that definition there?
So there hasn't been as much empirical research on charisma and psychopathy as you might think. But certainly many clinicians who've worked with people who were psychopathic and people with personality disorders more generally will say that they can often be very good at getting you to like them and getting you to enjoy interacting with them. And this is one of the things that I think is tricky about people with psychopathy. And I should emphasize that I'm one of the only people in the world who run the nonprofit organization aimed at helping people who are psychopathic. It's the website is called Psychopathy Is, and we're really trying to provide resources and information for people who are psychopathic because it is a psychological disorder and people with it often need help. That said, it is also important for people who are in the community of people who are psychopathic to understand the myths versus the reality about how to recognize somebody with psychopathy. Most people have a tendency to confuse whether they personally like somebody and enjoy them with whether that person is a good person. And the reality is that many people who have personality disorders may want you to really like them so that they can get things out of you or so that they can use you in some other way. And it oftentimes, when people discover that somebody that they really liked turns out to have been psychopathic under the surface, they're just shocked because they think, well, I really like this person. They were always so nice to me. I was like, well, it turns out that being really nice to people is often a really good way to manipulate them and use them. And I say this with hesitation because, of course, most people are nice just because they're nice. But people who are psychopathic have what's called a mask of sanity, where they seem, a completely typical, ordinary person, even a little bit better than ordinary, charismatic often, very likable on the surface. But underneath, they just aren't driven by the same emotions that most people are.
You mentioned that their amygdala is different compared to the altruist that you look at. And one of the things you did, which I thought was interesting, was to show people, pictures of someone being afraid. So the signs of that are wide eyes, raised eyebrows, maybe even a grimacing mouth. And the psychopath doesn't what? Recognize, or the person with psychopathic traits does not recognize that is fear in another person.
In general, people who are psychopathic are not, they're not kind of low empathy in general, in the sense that they can't understand how other people are feeling. They can understand how other people are feeling and what they're thinking most of the time just fine if they bother. A lot of the time, they don't bother empathizing with other people, but if they do bother, then they can do it fine. But they do seem to really struggle to understand and recognize other people's fear because it's emotion they don't feel as strongly, and in some cases, don't feel at all.
Does that
And
make it
again, it's
not their? This gets into maybe even almost legal issues, but I mean, is that the kind of Twinkie defense, which is, well, my amygdala made me do it. I'm not responsible for my behavior.
It turns out that that's not a very successful defense most of the
Okay,
time
good.
because it's not that they don't know what they're doing is against the rules or against the law. It's just that they are not that concerned about breaking the law. And so that's, it's not a great legal defense to say, well, the structure of my brain is probably different. And again, we don't have our brain imaging tools are not sophisticated enough to ever diagnose somebody with psychopathy. We're working toward that, maybe. But there's no question that people who are psychopathic have brains that develop differently, that causes them to feel emotions differently and behave in ways that other people wouldn't. So, on the one hand, I do believe that everybody is responsible for their own behavior. So if somebody does something to harm somebody else, they are responsible for that, as long as they were not intellectually disabled or had, schizophrenia in the moment. However, it's not that I don't feel compassion for people who are psychopathic. I do, because they didn't choose to have these personality traits. Nobody would choose to be this way. And especially if you're working with children, I mean, they didn't choose to be this way. And so they do deserve help and treatment, just like people with any other disorder do, even if they don't always elicit compassion from us.
Well, I wonder even if you dug deeper on with someone with psychopathic traits, let's say the bully. I've always sort of believed that if you really dug deep into the bully, you would find a fearful person, and you would find someone with great fears. That's why they're acting in such bullying ways.
Sometimes you will, but with truly psychopathic people, you won't. It's unfortunately one of the real holdovers of the Freudian era of psychology that there's a tendency to assume that any adult psychopathology is a result of some sort of childhood trauma. And obviously, a subset of children, most don't, but a subset of children experience real trauma early in life and it can have after effects. But in general, those do not include being psychopathic. Truly psychopathic people, again, tend to be relatively fearless early in life. It makes them sort of insensitive to the mild punishments that most children respond to, things like timeouts. Causes them to experience a lot of conflict with their parents because the parents are so frustrated that these punishments aren't working. And sometimes then the parents escalate things, unfortunately. Children who are psychopathic often don't seem to want a lot of warmth and affection. They may seem to resist it. And so parents, often thinking they're being respectful, will not treat them with as much warmth and affection. And of course, because psychopathic traits are in part genetic, sometimes the parents themselves have these traits or some element of these traits themselves. Not always, but sometimes. And so over time, this escalating conflict leads the children to develop worse behavior problems and worse kind of beliefs and perceptions of others that turn into these callous and emotional and then psychopathic traits. And so while there is sort of a developmental process that leads to these traits, my experiences in working with people who have primary psychopathy is that there's no deep down fear. There's deep down a desire to get what you want. And a lifetime of sort of learned behaviors about how to get what you want that are socially unacceptable and hurt other people. And if you're just not that sensitive to other people's distress or suffering, hurting other people just doesn't really bother you that much. And that's something you need to unlearn.
Well, and I have a lot of sympathy. I'm sure a lot of people do for then parents raising a child with these tendencies and these traits. So, if the idea is I don't care, you can do whatever you want to me, and I'm not going to apologize, or I'm not going to, change my ways. What does a parent do? How do you raise a child that seems to have these tendencies?
It's really hard. And I mean, I have so much compassion for parents of these kids because what happens is because we tend to believe that any kind of psychopathology must reflect hideous treatment, maltreatment, or trauma, it's assumed that parents of these
It's their
children
fault.
are abusive, cold, unloving parents. And P.S., this is what we also used to believe about parents of children with autism and parents of children with schizophrenia until they were recognized as neurodevelopmental disorders that, have much more complicated biological roots. The same is true of psychopathy, and yet we still treat these parents sort of by default as though they caused these problems in their children. So it really is rough. Now, that's not to say that parents can't learn new approaches to raising their children that will make their children better. It may not bring them all the way to baseline, but it will certainly improve them, and it's better the earlier you start. So as soon as you start recognizing that your child seems to be impervious to danger, impervious to the possibility of being punished, maybe less warm and affectionate than other kids. P.S. This can be a little bit difficult to distinguished from autistic traits
I
in
was
some
wondering
kids.
about
So
that.
it's really important to get good diagnosis, which is not that easy. But if you get these kids into programs where the parents learn therapeutic techniques to work with their child, you really can improve their behavior. And the gist of it is, you basically have to make sure, A, that you have a lot of warm, loving interactions with a child who doesn't seem to want them. You have to give them this deep knowledge that other people are fundamentally good and kind. And you have to sort of overwhelm them in some cases with warmth and love. But you can't let them get their way
Well,
when they're
that's the
trying to
tricky
do.
part, right.
Yes, you can't let them get their way when they're trying to do antisocial things, because those things are intrinsically rewarding to children who are antisocial. They find it fun, unfortunately, to do things that they shouldn't, and including sometimes to hurt other kids. And so parent management training programs, like there's one called parent-child interaction therapy that seems to be especially effective, or PCIT, trains parents to use basic principles of reinforcement and psychology to ensure that children get more rewarded when they do the right thing than when they do the wrong thing. And anybody can learn in those contexts. It just takes some patience and time. And they can get better, even if, they may still have a little bit more disruptive behavior than the average kid.
Let me get back to some, I guess, sort of larger sociological questions or issues. And I'm curious about if you think sort of mob psychology or group behavior, affects, let's say, someone who's, I don't want to give anyone a diagnosis here, but someone who's sort of attracted to violence or maybe even a charismatic leader that is sort of encouraging some of this negative behavior. What do you see as the role of the group? Because I think oftentimes people will do things in a group they would never, ever do by themselves.
Absolutely true. Social psychologists have found for many years that in large groups, people feel a sense of anonymity and a lack of responsibility for their behavior. And so, mobs and things like that, you'll see people engaging in behavior that they normally wouldn't. Part of the reason for this is that people follow social norms.
We're conformists, right?
Yeah, well, that's good, right? That helps us stay interconnected into a group. If we all sort of are like, okay, well, this is the behavior we're all going to adopt, and then it makes it just so much easier to get along, up to a point. And so, one of the most successful ways we've known for a long time to get people to change their behavior, whether it's recycling or, using less electricity in their house, is just to give them correct information about what the community average is. If you tell people, on average, most people in your community recycle, and it looks like you don't, that will actually will change most people's behavior. They're like, oh, I don't want to be odd man
The
out here.
outlier, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if people believe that antisocial behavior is accepted and permissible in their community, they will be much more likely to behave antisocially themselves than if they believe that most people don't do that kind of behavior. And the same is true for pro-social behavior. If you see that most people around you are behaving pro-socially, you're much more likely to behave that way themselves. So you can get into either ascending or descending spirals.
Almost out of time here, but I read, and you can correct me if I misread this, that you talked about empathy, compassion, and guilt going together. Is that
Yeah, they
you? Is
do.
that you?
Yeah. So since I published my book, I feel like I understand the relationship among these things a little bit better. I now believe that empathy itself is not the root of why people behave well or badly. And this is because we now know so much about how common empathy is in the animal kingdom. I mean, zebrafish show a form of empathy. All mammals are capable of empathizing, sort of simulating, and recognizing their compatriots' emotional states. And all people can do it too, including people who are psychopathic. The question is whether we do it, right? When do we empathize with other people? And it turns out we mostly empathize with people we care about. And if I can get you to care about somebody, then you will empathize with them naturally. And if you've decided you don't care about somebody, then you won't empathize with them. It's as simple as that. And that's how, horrific national tragedies happen, where one group of people who themselves are people capable of empathy and care treat another group of people badly, is usually because they've decided that group is not worthy of care for some reason. Guilt. is the belief that you obviously, or is a negative feeling that you should have done something that you didn't, because usually because you ended up hurting somebody else. There's a very strong relationship between the tendency to care about others and the tendency to experience guilt. And I think, guilt is just that emotion that you feel that sort of is kind of like a self-punishment when you didn't meet your own standards of behavior. Now, it can go awry, right? Some people feel guilty about things that they don't need to feel guilty about, and that's not a good thing to feel. But in general, a little bit of guilt is what psychologists call a pro-social emotion.
Well, Abigail Marsh, we've got to leave it there with a little bit of guilt. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, she's a psychologist at Georgetown University. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Debbie Builder produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.